What's up? Y'all good?
Can y'all hear me? All right, all right, all right.
What's up, Kaya? Yeah. Man, I'm excited to be here. I'm very clear that I'm standing between you and who you all really came for. So we won't hold us long. But can we thank God for your pastor in his absence tonight? Amen. Love that dude. That's a dude that I do love. He's a good dude, and so I'm grateful for him, for Elijah, for the whole Kaya team who's responsible for me being here today. I want to say at the outset that I think it would be criminal of me to try to give an interpretation of the show in front of a cast member. So what we'll do is I'll save my commentary on the show for Q&A, so it's more like we're engaging each other instead of me acting like an authority on the show, right? But part of the beauty of the show is that it causes us to engage parts of our personalities that we often try to hide. It allows us to look at someone else's life and for a time and in ways that aren't as destructive as other times when we compare ourselves to other people. But looking at the characters on the show, it seems like each one of them, you can see pieces and traces of yourself. And it allows you to interrogate and to engage those parts of you that you hope nobody ever finds out about you, right? That's what I think the beauty of the show is, because it shows us the democracy of being imperfect, right? We often think that there is some perfect human, some perfect version of who you want to be, some perfect version of what you aspire to be in the world. And it is that addiction to perfection. It is that intoxication with searching and groping for a you that is not the real you. A you that does not have resonance in your heart nor resonance in the mind of God. And part of what that shows, seeing their imperfections, watching them wrestle with their insecurities, watching them explain away and then apologize for their limitations, watching them go from relationship to relationship, from situationship to situationship, from family drama to family drama, allows us to see that there's something very universal about being imperfect, something universal about being insecure. So that is the reason why it was a good idea to use the show to frame our conversation tonight. They didn't ask me to preach. They told me to have a conversation tonight. And so I try just to have a conversation tonight. But I'm really curious. Do you ever wake up and not know who you are? Are there ever days that you are wrestling with who you want to be in the world versus who you have been, which is often shaped and connected to what you have experienced in life? Part of the nature of being insecure is this myth that we are not enough as we are. These assumptions that we have inherited from the world around us that can convince us that there's something that we are deeply missing, that there's something that is not quite full about us, something that is not quite real about us. And there are days where I actually don't know who I want to be that day. There are some days I wake up and I'm in a good mood. And then there are some days I wake up and I am, to some extent, dissatisfied with where I am in life. And I'm a dude who, he told you, I went to Morehouse and went to Harvard. And for some reason, none of that satisfies me most days of my life. right? These are things that I invested time, went into debt for. Right? Sally Mae owns more of me than my mama owns of me, right? All right. And there was a time where I assumed that these particular attainments of education were going to fulfill me, were going to speak to me, were going to nourish those places in me that I felt were missing, right? And then one day I woke up and I realized that I did a lot of what I've done in life trying to please a man I've never met, my father. Years trying to live up to expectations that I'm sure he never even had of me. How do I know? He never even bothered to call to even see how I was doing. But in my mind, I used this another achievement, another accolade, another degree, another title, another platform, believing that there was something. I'm not conscious of this. Don't get me wrong. I'm not conscious of this. I'm not actively getting up saying, man, how can I impress my dad today? No. But there was something, right? But there was something lurking inside of me, this specter, this ghost that had been haunting me since I was 10 years old, telling me if I can just do enough, then maybe I can make my dad proud. If my name will show up on this website, maybe I can make my dad proud. If I've tweeted something that went viral, maybe it could make my dad proud. So much so, maybe if I preach the right sermon at the right place, maybe my dad would hear the sermon and say it's a word that blessed him, right? I realized that the moment and the sense of unfulfillment was connected to the things that I thought were going to feed me and nourish me. I had pursued them for the wrong reasons. I had given too much energy and attention to a person who I love, because I guess I'm supposed to love him. But a person who I love, but a person who was probably not worth all the time that I invested in him, right? And that's my dad. So now shift to think about the types of things we do to please people who only have temporary places in our lives. The things we do to please people who actually only want one or two things from us, and you know what the one thing they want from you is, right? And we build these narratives, and we allow our decisions to be shaped and formed because we don't feel like we're enough. That's what's at the heart of being insecure, this sense of not being enough. This sense that if you can just get one more thing, that there's this vacuum in you, this hole that you try to fill in the blanks with things that don't have the power to keep you or to sustain you. To fill yourself with things that look good, but things that do not actually allow you to feel the genuine and authentic power of who you actually are, right? So that's why when you have a conversation about insecurities, it is really a call, it is a summons, it is a beckoning for you to actually decide to be in a relationship with yourself, right? And not in the way like, oh, I'm gonna take myself out, I don't need nobody to take me out, I'm good all by myself. In fact, me and Jesus, if a man don't want me, if a woman don't want me, I'm good with Jesus. Nah, that's scapegoating, and that you don't even believe it when you say it, right? But right. And then we try to over-spiritualize, well, this is my season of singleness, and God, I have an apostolic assignment to be single in this season, right? God anointed me to be by myself, and yeah, no, right. And that may be real for some folk, for people who have had that kind of experience. I ain't trying to take that from you, right? But for those of us who have not had that experience, we use it as armor, right? Because every day we reach for spiritual armor, emotional armor to guard ourselves from the blows that life throws at us, because we often believe that life is supposed to be more kind to us than life ever promised to be to us, right? So we collect emotional armor, right? Usually by numbing ourselves, by trying to find satisfaction in distractions, or we work ourselves to death, right? That's armor, right? It's nothing more than emotional armor. But there is a need for us, even if you are in a fulfilling friendship, fulfilling relationship, fulfilling family, there is still a need for you to take the time and have a crash course with yourself. Because there are places within you, there are places deep down inside that are both light and darkness. And you'll never be able to embrace the light of your life if you do not learn how to lean into the darkness within you. There's nothing inherently wrong with dark, right? Look at this. This is beautiful. Beautiful, right? I am often turned off by the light and dark language because seemingly darkness is always bad, right? But no, darkness is not always bad, but sometimes darkness is the only place where the best you can grow, right? I never want you to forget that. Anybody just has some times that you consider dark? Dark emotions, dark finances, dark family experience, like the way we traditionally talk about darkness, right, as these negative seasons. And I had to learn that in me, I am both dusk and dawn. I am both night and day. I am both light and dark. And I had to learn to affirm myself as a complicated manifestation of a creative God. That's what I had to figure out that I was. That I'm complicated. I'm moody. Right? I told you some days I wake up and I ain't feeling me. Right? Because I'm moody and I can get there in a moment. Right? But I had to wrestle with the fact that I am both light and dark. And people who cannot handle my darkness, they don't deserve my light. Right? Because there are parts in me, places in me, there are aspects of my personality that may not be palatable for some people, but the reality is that those are places where I am still growing. Those are places where I'm still developing. And so this is an obligation for you, yes, to claim and love your light, but you also have an obligation to lean into your darkness. Because possibly in your darkness, you will find some of the greatest untapped possibilities that you will ever have access to. But we often miss our greatest potential, our greatest possibilities, our greatest versions of ourselves, because we spend so much time running away from the us that people have designed, that people have determined were problematic, that we have bought into the narratives that other people have spoken over us and to us, that we forget that all of me is actually blessed, right? Your light is not only blessed, your good days are not only blessed, but you are blessed even when you feel like you are at your worst. How? Because darkness is not antithetical to God's presence. Now, I need you to hear that. I need you to hear that. Because if you're going to learn how to lean into the dark, you got to reimagine what the darkness actually is. Because even when you look in scripture, you will find out that wherever there's darkness, that is where God is. That you don't often find God in the light. I know we sing songs like "Walk in the Light." I know it's a younger clever. "Walk in the light, beautiful light." All right. "Come where the dew drops of mercy sound bright." You ever heard that song? Okay. Y'all are churchy. Okay, cool. But when you look throughout the scripture, you will find out that God has an intimate relationship with darkness. How is it? Look at Genesis and the very creation. What does it say? That in the beginning, God was hovering over the face of the deep. The earth was out form and void, and darkness covered the earth. God had to create light. Because God was already living in darkness. Why? Because God's original habitat was not light, because light is a creation of God, but God's original habitat was actually the darkness. Right? And so when you think about the dark seasons of your life, you have to remind yourself that God's native location is not in the light, but God's native location is in the dark. Now, why is that important? Because the first thing God creates is light. And so when God decides to create light, he does not do it in light. But when God decides to start the creative process, God starts creating in the dark. Which means that God does creative work in our nights, in our dark seasons. And that is a power that you have to begin to embrace and to say that darkness is really the canvas for God's creativity. Yeah. Every moment of darkness that you tried to run away from, every moment of darkness that you thought would seize you, every moment of darkness that you thought you could not overcome, every moment of darkness that you thought was too thick and too strong and too deep for you, you have to remind yourself that it's in the dark that God is at home. Why? So there was something that I had to do. I had to shift from thinking about myself as good and bad, light and dark, and realize that I am a complicated manifestation of God's creativity. That is who you are. When you declare that you are made in the image of God, you are declaring that you're a complicated manifestation of God's creativity. You are a complex construct of God's creative power. That is who you are. If you know and you own the fact that you have been fearfully and wonderfully made, you are declaring that there is something of God that is resident in you. And this is one of the first steps to reclaiming your life from the narratives that you've allowed to dominate your ears. This is reclaiming your heart from the stories that you've allowed to hold you hostage for so long. This is the first step to reclaiming the you that you actually want to be and can be in spite of the you that you've been turned into, not simply because of you have bought into the rumors and the lies that other people have sold you about you, but you begin to reclaim yourself from the mask that you put on that you begin to believe are your real face. Because that is part of the danger, is that when you trick yourself to believe that you're someone you're not, when you convince yourself that you are something lower than you actually are, overcoming insecurities requires you to actually have a crash course in self for you to reclaim, re-engage, lean into the power of your identity. And sometimes that requires you to interrogate your darkness. Why? Because the beauty of the show is that there is no one on the show who lives outside of the oddities. Now, Drew is one of the cruelest persons on the show, but he got some issues too, right? I ain't talking about Jackson, I'm talking about Drew. I'm talking about the character, I ain't talking about him, man. But it shows us this, as I started with this sort of democracy of imperfection, the democracy of insecurities. It reminds us that all of us have issues and have concerns, right? All of us have moments where we feel like we're not doing enough. If you can be honest with yourself, how many times, you know your life is good, right? You got a good job, you have great degrees, you're doing well. But how often do you look at Facebook and you think that somebody's life is better than yours, or Twitter or Instagram, whatever it is? Because it's so easy to spend time scrolling and forget all the things you do, all the investments you have, and you begin to invest in people who you don't even know. The stroke of a hand, swipe left, whatever it is, right? And you begin to, with each swipe, you begin to convince yourself that you are not worthy and you are not enough. Somebody's relationship is better than mine. Somebody's clothes are better than mine. Somebody's friend circle is tighter than mine. Someone's job is better than mine. Someone's spiritual life is better than mine. It is too easy to spend time comparing ourselves with people who only tell you what they want you to know. I don't know very many people who are streaming all of their bad moments, right? That is the beauty of social media. You get to curate your identity. Because really, we don't even meet each other on social media. We meet our representatives. We send out the us we want people to know. Oh, no, we send out the us that we think other people can handle. as opposed to leaning in the us that we actually are. All right. There's this brother, y'all may know him. His name's Saul. Saul, king of Israel. The first king of Israel, right? When God was not even sure that God was going to give Israel a king, Saul became the first pick, right? And how is Saul found? You can find this in 1 Samuel 9 and 10, right? You can find 1 Samuel 9 and 10. But when we find Saul, who we know will eventually become king, we don't find Saul in a family of honor or a family of high repute. But we find Saul in one of the tribes that is least known, Benjamin. And we find Saul chasing after lost animals. That's where we find him. That his life is interrupted by the intrusion of God's presence and God's word while he is chasing after lost animals. I really wish y'all felt that right there, right? That he is too busy trying to handle somebody else's sheep, somebody else's cattle, that he finds himself lost looking for something else that's lost, right? And I wonder, and that's the beauty of, I think, God, that God never, that it would be good, it would be a great, great testimony if all of us could say that God found us in places where we're actually supposed to be, right? But for most of us, we had the most authentic encounters with God, not in sanctuaries like this, but some of our most authentic encounters with God when we were actually lost chasing after other lost stuff, right? Where we were actually out of place, out of bounds, where we actually found ourselves in moments and in spaces that did not feed us, did not nurture us, did not encourage us, did not empower us, but we found ourselves lost only because we were chasing after stuff that never wanted to be found in the first place. Now, I need you to hear that, because how often do we chase after people, after things that don't want to be found? And we spend all of this energy chasing after stuff that doesn't want to be found. We spend all of this energy, all this time building in relationships and friendships and networks and jobs and internships that actually will not get us to the next level, simply because we've convinced ourselves that this dream is enough. Have you ever been there? Where God had to deliver you from your small dream because you could not embrace the big dream that God had for you because you were too busy chasing after the lost. Right? I think that's powerful for us to really think about, is that how often do we invest too much energy in things that cannot get us to the very places where we say we want to go? We have these 5-year plans. Right? On paper. Right? Or maybe, no, in the phone. Right? But at what point do you allow the dreams that you have for yourself to actually catch up with the dreams that God has for you? He finds himself lost. God finds him while he is lost. And he's lost chasing after animals who don't want to be found by him. Right. He's investing all of this energy in something that he's outgrown. Because the sheep, the cattle don't belong to him. He has already, maybe he senses something in his life that he knows that his life is bigger than what he's allowed his life to become. He knows that his next is bigger than what he's allowed himself to see. He knows that what's possible in his life is stronger and broader than what he's allowed himself to see. But for some reason, he's too committed to what had got away that he doesn't spend time thinking about what's next. Now, that can go in a lot of places, right? When you think about, you spend all this energy chasing after stuff that got away instead of putting energy in the things that are propping up. Like, sometimes things just are providentially placed in your life that are just waiting for you to grab. That there are some things in your world that are in your network, in your economy, in your orbit, and you miss them simply because your eyes are on the things that you can't see anymore because it's too far gone. But your mind is stuck there. That's all. He spends all of this energy chasing after animals that got away. But it was in that moment, while he was lost, that he had a creative encounter with God, right? So maybe I should have. Anybody ever spent time on the wrong stuff? Too much time on the wrong stuff? I have a niece. My niece is 9. She's a Scorpio too, like me. And some Scorpios in the house. Love it, love it, love it. Scorpios and Scorpio lovers in the house. Love it, love it. But my niece, man, my niece is finally getting some chores. I'm excited that she's getting some chores. She's gonna learn how to do things. They call me, tell me she's gonna learn how to do things around the house. And what I love is that my mom is a plant collector. It's like a forest when you go into my mom's house, because she just has plants everywhere, plant lady, right? And so my mom has all types of plants in the house. I won't even dare to name them, but my niece got the assignment to water the plants. That's what she was supposed to do. She's supposed to water the plants, right? And I'm thinking my mom's getting ready to tell me a story like she killed my plants because she overwatered them, and now she got to go. I'm thinking my mom's going, those are like her children. Right? Those are like her children, right? And so she says, yeah, I saw Janiah watering the plants, and I caught her, and I had to ask her, why are you watering that plant? And my mom ain't giving me details yet. I said, why are you watering that plant? And Janiah says, well, you told me to water the plants if I want my allowance, right? And she says, yeah, but that plant is a plastic plant. And Janiah says, but it looks real. And so what I found out is that sometimes we spend so much time watering plastic things in our lives that cannot grow because they've never been alive. Something cannot grow if it was never alive in the first place. And we spend so much time trying to water things that have never been alive, that could never grow. And so you waste all of this energy, all of this water, all of this authority, all of this strength, investing in things that cannot grow. You better learn how to smell a fake when you come in contact with it. Right? Because you can waste years wasting your hard-earned I know, can I get a witness? Can I get a witness? You can waste years and resources watering things that cannot grow because they never were alive. And you wonder, why won't this job shift? Why won't this relationship take the turn? Why is this friendship still feeling plastic? Why do I feel like people are just hanging out with me for what I can do for them and not really hanging out with me for me? It's because you have not checked to see whether or not it's fake or real. He was chasing after lost stuff. But that's not it. He runs into Samuel. Y'all heard of Samuel before? He runs into the priest, Samuel. And Samuel gives him a word, right? I'm gonna rush it. Samuel anoints him to be king. But that's not the end. After he leaves Samuel, the Bible says that he has this prophetic frenzy where he's going out and speaking truth. He's losing it, right? He has this encounter with God that is supposed to make a difference in his life, right? He's already been anointed. He has this direct encounter with God. But the day it is announced that he's supposed to be king, the Bible says that when they call his name, he's nowhere to be found. Hear this. He's been anointed to be king. He's had the dream to be a king. He has this prophetic frenzy that reminds him that he just had an encounter with God. But the moment that it's time for him to claim what God dreamt for him, he ain't nowhere to be found. So they call on God, and God says, no, go find him. He's hiding in the baggage. That's scripture. I wish I had made that up, right? He's been anointed. He's had the dream to do this. He has had a prophetic encounter with God. But the moment it's time for him to stand up for what he had been prepared for, he's hiding in the baggage. And how often do we find ourselves running away from the us that is actually vulnerable and risky? Because part of the shift has to be that you begin to tell yourself that vulnerability is actually a gift. Because you can only be hurt if you actually have love in the first place. People who don't matter to you can't hurt you. And so the real sign, so what you should really be thinking about when your heart breaks is not, oh, I can't believe this person did this to me, but you should really begin to tell yourself, wow, I couldn't believe I loved that much. It's a shift. You begin to affirm your vulnerability, because what it tells you is that you're still alive and you're still human. And life is not worth living if you're not willing to risk the vulnerability and the pain of being in love. Those of us who love the most can be hurt the most. Those of us who hope the most can have the most despair. Those of us who commit the most are those of us who can be disappointed the most. And this is learning how to re-narrate who you are and how things affect you in your life. It is not worth your time to allow something that happened 10 years ago to still be puppeting your life 10 years later. Why? Because you have not reclaimed the power. Reclaiming the power is saying, I'm not going to think about what she did to me, what he did to me, but I'm going to tell myself, at least you were able to experience love while you had it. Right? It's a shift that allows you to reclaim the sovereignty of your own life. That is what most of us are missing. We no longer have control of our lives because we have sold ourselves off to the highest bidder. We've given ourselves away to ideas and things that don't actually matter in the long run. And we spend time, we allow the wounds of today to still fester without healing down the road, right? And, you know, I am who I am, so I gotta say this as well, is that we often forget the role that white supremacy plays in how we view ourselves and see ourselves. Yeah, I know people don't like to talk about white supremacy, and that's because we think white supremacy is about white men carrying tiki torches in khaki pants, talking about down with this person, down with that person. No, but we forget that white supremacy is alive in every institution in this country. There's a reason why black women make less than white women, black men, and white men. Why? It's because white supremacy is at work. There's a reason why black girls get suspended at a higher rate than any other cohort in the school. It's because white supremacy is real. And we have to always interrogate how we allow white supremacy to shape us and to control us. Because if we'll be honest, sometimes white supremacy can inhabit black bodies. I really wish that white supremacy was only about white people. But the reality is that there are those people, I think Angela Ross says, that there are skin folk, but not our kin folk. Y'all know those folk? Right there? Uh-huh. Yeah, because sometimes white supremacy can inhabit black bodies. And sometimes we begin to judge who we are against the fake, weak template of white supremacy. We allow the world to tell us what we're capable of, what we can do, what we can handle. We begin to feed ourselves narratives of defeat. I know everybody doesn't do it, but sometimes you have to wake up and be conscious not only to how your interpersonal lives have caused you to drift, but sometimes how have the structures and forces in this country convinced you of what your limitations are and what you cannot overcome. You know, every day you need to declare an emancipation from your limitations. Every day you need to abolish what you can't do. And instead of doing what you can do, how about you do the courageous thing and try something you thought you could not do? That is how you begin to condition yourself to believe that you're enough, but you never believe that you are enough if you keep on convincing yourself of what you cannot do. He was anointed to be king. He had a creative encounter with God. He had dreams of being king, but the reality is when the time came, he couldn't see it, so he went hiding. He went running in the other direction. And so if we are going to be the love revolutionaries that God has called us to be, if we're going to lean into the reality of the complex creativity of who we are, then you have to remind yourself that you actually are enough. In spite of what it looks like, in spite of what it sounds like, in spite of what you have been through, in spite of what you have been in the past, you have to remind yourself that you are enough. And you have to break up with the myth of perfection. You have to declare today that you're divorcing yourself from the myths that you have allowed to take over your heart and take over your spirit. Why can you do this? Because if God can see the impossible in you, why can't you? God, who knows your flaws better than you, but God trusts you. I often like to tell people, it amazes me that God trusts me more than I trust God, and God knows all my flaws, right? And the only reason why you are alive is because the world has something that you need. That is why Romans says creation is waiting for the revealing of the sons and daughters of God. That there is something in this world that is waiting for you to reclaim your life, because the world will not be what it needs to be unless you declare that you are who God says you are, and you believe that there is something that only you can leave behind in this world. And what you can believe, what you can leave behind in this world is not connected to a paycheck. It's not connected to a large following. It's not connected to the things that we allow ourselves to become the hallmarks of success. But it is when you know that every single day that you are contagious life. That everywhere you go, that place shifts and changes simply because you showed up. That you begin to know that your footsteps are beating the path towards the best version of you and beating the path for the best version of the world, because the world cannot be who the world needs to be unless the world has you declaring that you can be you courageously. I'm done. But hear this though. And then Brother Jackson's going, we're going to have this conversation. You come on, man. We're going to talk. Come on. We're sitting right here, right? We're sitting right here. But you got to tell yourself every single day that you are enough. And you are enough because you were born enough. Before Jesus ever opened a blind eye, before he ever raised anyone from the dead, before he ever healed or cured anybody, God says, "This is my beloved son, in whom I'm well pleased." You do not earn your enough. You cannot deserve your enough. You are inherently enough because you have God's DNA running through you. And that ought to remind you every day that you can love yourself and affirm yourself and encourage yourself and promote yourself and, here it is, be the most revolutionary self that you can be. Why? Because if God says you're enough, Who cares what anybody else says? So I'm gonna turn this over to Brother Jackson, and then he's gonna make some comments. And am I doing the right thing, bro? Okay, he's gonna give some remarks, and then we're opening up for Q&A. That's real? Okay.
Yeah. Go ahead, make a few comments, and then we'll open up, and we'll take some questions from the floor. So get your questions ready, Brother Jackson.
Okay. Y'all can hear me? Oh man, wow. Okay.
I'm glad we're sitting down, because if we were standing up, I wouldn't like that too much. That's one of my insecurities. It's one of my insecurities.
Amazing, by the way. Wow, that was amazing. I appreciate all your words. Yeah, that was amazing. I will say, there's a lot of things to touch on or piggyback off. When you were talking about the light and the darkness, why that was sitting so strong with me was because I remember the day when, and nothing tragic happened in my life. I mean, there's been, you know, tragic moments in lives, all of us have been through stuff. But there was a moment where I just knew, I knew I wasn't happy, right? And in being younger and always expecting a different result but staying the same finally didn't make sense to me. And I was consciously aware of that. And I remember looking at myself in the mirror and saying, if you want different results, then you need to improve yourself as a man, and you need to improve your ways. You need to confront that, and then from there on out, I became a better brother, a better friend, a better son, just a better human being. But that came from me feeling that would have been at that time when I was in my darkness. So yeah, that really sat well with me. I appreciate those words, that was great. So much he said though. I just appreciate that. Yeah, man. But yeah, let's go back and forth. Let's do this. Let's go.
Am I on? All right, let's. I'm gonna ask a question. I like Dro, man. You know, I like Dro
has some. Come on, with it. Come on, let's do
Dro
it.
Dro has some privileges, man. That I'm like, man, people can't get away with that, bro. You know.
Yeah.
Man, talk me through, because there's something about that relationship model that is seemingly malignant. This open marriage situation, right?
Right.
It sounds millennial. It sounds, you know, there's a type of freedom. There's a type of freedom inherent in there. So,
break it down.
Talk about that character, man.
I've talked about this a few times. Obviously, being in the situation within this show, which is not a conventional thing, people get, obviously, there's a lot of questions about it. And my job as an artist or as an actor is to not judge the character, rationalize everything, is to try to give an authentic feel to this as much as possible. So, you know, if I'm judging this, you know, there might be a disconnect, and I don't want that. He says there's a line that Dro said the first time him and Molly really have a long conversation at that club. He says people just have to find what works with them. And in his mind, that's what he feels works with them. And I think I've encountered a lot of people now, like I guess I'm the face of open marriages. I've never been married in my life, but that's just what it is. So having conversations with people, you know, I mean, I've met all type of people, a wide range of ages as well, talk about their experiences. And the common thing I've come across is I guess there's people don't want to feel, they don't want to, in their words, they don't want to face limitations, I guess, or force limitations upon someone else. Mm-hmm. A lot of them feel like it's as if they don't want to be forced through society's eyes of what a relationship is, or these are just things that, you know, I've heard from different people who are in those situations, and that's been a common thing. So that's been interesting to kind of explore and then relay that to the team of writers and producers on our show and try to, massage that into to the story. But it's been an interesting journey to portray that character, and especially it's been interesting where I've had this conversation with our creators as well, with Prentice, with Issa, and it's to be in that relationship, but also be the most honest character on the show, but have people feel that you aren't honest at all, mm-hmm. is because it's so unconventional, and so people don't necessarily face it all the time, right?
Yeah.
So that has been interesting, obviously, and that just having people who I don't know approach me with animosity. So. That's always been interesting, but yeah. So it's definitely some an aspect of relationships which, you know, it works for some people, and some people have tried it, and for a lot of people, it's just not their cup of tea.
Yeah. I mean, Joe is the most honest character on the show. There's something deeply communicative about him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's committed to the truth.
Yeah.
And that kind of animosity that you say you experience actually suggests that people actually don't like truthful people. People may not actually be able to handle the truth that cuts against their assumptions.
Yeah.
And so what does it mean to live this kind of authentic you, right, when you're being honest, when you're being yourself? And right, people are like, yeah, I can't handle that. That's too much truth for me, right? I would prefer the fake plastic over the truth.
Right. You know what? It's funny enough, we're talking about this today. I was on Twitter, and there was a list that they made for the men of Insecure. And it goes from least F-boy to king F-boy.
Oh my gosh.
And to me, now, I'll just tell you where I fell on that list, and I'll tell you who was number one, because I was number two. Dro was two, and number one was Daniel. Right. Thank you.
What? Daniel?
Now,
like, what? Not my baby.
Now, their reasoning for that was that his pros were that he's always there for Issa, right? A crush, if you will. But his cons was he tends to, when things were going bad and things were negative, he would just put the blame onto Issa and never confront, which would be, they said, the worst type of F-boy, where it's not just your normal, like, liar or whatever like that. It's the good guy with good intentions, but then when things are rough, he tends to project. He tends to project, right? Which I was like, okay, that's fine. But going through the men on that show, and that's why I say I was like, it said a lot about the person, whoever's in charge of that list, because it came from like a blog. Like, there's a character named Chad on the show, right? Like, he literally just cheated.
Yep.
And he encourages it. you know? And then when he does something, he's like, oh. And then he brings up Issa, well, Issa, you know, he's like, yeah, but she's a, you know, she's a hoe. Like, that's what, you know, so he shames and he can't. And I was like, and then you have people, and I'm like, all right. And now me, I will proudly sit here and I'll tell people, yeah, I'm the ambassador of Lawrence Hive. That's me. I'm Lawrence Hive Strong, right? But I will call my brother out. Whatever. we can talk about it after. But, you know, I'm seeing what he was going through. I mean, he literally just took a trip to the doctor's office. And he's just aimlessly out there. And then he just, you know, I want a woman with no baggage. And his father, played by the amazing Harry Lennox, gave him knowledge, you know. And your mother had matching luggage, right? And you worked on it. And so I'm like, but just, so to, it's no other people that are on the show. I'm just like, why the most honest guys on the show were number one and two. And then the guys, like whoever, the most deserving to me was Chad, was like six or something. There's only like eight of us. So I was like, how's he so low on the totem pole? But yeah, and I do think it's like facing the the truth is a truth no matter what, whether it's pretty or ugly. And a lot of times it's ugly and people just don't want to embrace that. I just think, yeah, we need to kind of just lean into the truth more and embrace that as much as possible. So yeah.
Yes, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
We have one question. So I know we do have a lot of insecure fans in here, but we do have some people who've never seen the show before.
Okay.
So I know, crazy, right?
No judgment.
So if you could just summarize what the show is about.
Yeah.
What the intention is behind it, what it showcases, what it highlights, beyond the relationships, obviously, that we've talked about, and just kind of some of the lessons we can learn from the show.
Okay. For those who haven't seen the show, the show Insecure, basically, it follows our two leads, our Issa and Molly's black women who are best friends, who navigate through their life, and we see how they handle relationships, right? All type of relationship, whether it's friendships, romantic relationships, work relationships, career. We touch on race, in it, of course, just the realities of it in the workforce. And I think the reason why people have gravitated so much and identified with it is, one, the show is so important to the culture because there's only so many narratives that have been told about us on screen, which is so limiting because we're more than just, look, I love power, right? I love power. But I've seen a drug dealer all the time on screen. I've seen that since the day, you know, New Jack City. I've seen it since, you know, we go all the way back. Superfly, the original.
I'm a narrative.
you know, shout out to them, but, you know. But, like, So I've seen this since the beginning of time. We've seen us in the hood. We've seen us selling drugs. But there's such a wide lane of us. The most educated demographic in America is black women. Right? Which was crazy when you're talking about them being paid less than ever. I'm like, well, what are we doing here? They literally are more qualified than everybody here in America. It's crazy.
Built this country, man.
And then, but you see, when we are given opportunities, I'm on an amazing show that's created by a wonderful black woman, you know what I mean? When opportunities are given. And to see us, you know, more than that, and then of course, like, look, even though I'm gonna go see the Harriet Tubman movie when it comes out, I'm tired of slave movies. I've seen 12 Years a Slave once, and I'm not going to see it again. You know, it was a great movie, but I'm not seeing it again. I'm tired of seeing us in that light as well. And then the last one is going to be biopics. I love biopics, but that's the last one. You know, you're going to see Ray Charles, Muhammad Ali movie, all that stuff. It's great. But there's so many shows of our counterparts, you know, that they have, you know, you have friends. And it's like they could just be normal people, right? And you have Frasier and Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm, right?
Right.
And that you know, you could just see them in different lanes where, you know, just so many different stories that they're allowed to tell. But when it comes to us, it's like we're only going to green light, for those who know the term in the business, green light means like we're only going to say yes to making this if you know, it's a slave movie, a biopic, or if you're selling drugs, right? So for HBO to be so great and give Issa this opportunity to show us, like, our educated women, you know, Molly, right? Probably doing the best in show career-wise, but then you get to see her struggles in other ways. Showing Issa at a nonprofit and just showing, like, you know, we're not always, like, because we're always supposed to be so strong in the world's eyes. We're, you know, we're, like, you know, that's why, I mean, of course, you know, we could talk about police brutality, but they're so aggressive towards us because they think we're aggressive, we're strong, we're supposed to jump the highest, run the fastest. Black women are supposed to be the strongest women out there, you know, they're supposed to handle so much. Everyone's supposed to be Serena Williams and amazing at what they do or something. So when you're seeing us as the most, you know, on this show, you're seeing us in vulnerable moments. You're seeing successful Black people. You're seeing people figure it out, though. You're seeing people struggle. You're seeing Black love, whether it's working or whether it's not working. You know, we're seeing that, you know, on the other side, like, this is a reason why I've never connected to a character more in my life than I've seen Lawrence, because I was on the end of, you know, in my first relationship ever, you know, being one that's cheated on. You know what I mean? You know? Because we're always going to see, like, you know, I mean, look, you know, brothers mess up a lot out here. We should do better. But we do see that narrative a lot on TV. You know, we're going to see that. That's normal to see. But to see the flip of that, you know, and for us to go there and show different things, and my character being an open relationship, we don't necessarily see that happen often, especially in our community. That's like whoa, no, we don't do that. You know what I mean? So to show the different strokes of us and to see us, the complexities, the layers, the dualities of Black people, because, I mean, we really are magical people, and there's so many, we're so different. We're not all the same. They try to stroke us with the same brush, but it's just not true. You know, we're so different. We have different backgrounds. You know, there's people who are first generation Africans. There's people I was talking about, like, my family ain't been an African since the slave trade, you know? So it's just like, you know, there's Afro-Latinos, there's Creole people, there's all types of people. So to show us just different people, it's been something that's been a hit for the culture and important, and that's been important to us as a cast and crew, and we appreciate you guys so much for the support and really having it resonate with you guys and just responding so well, because we really do it for us by us. It's really for us by us, really do, so yeah.
All right, we'll open up the floor for some questions.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you how becoming a father has changed you as a man.
Yes.
And what would you say to encourage other absentee fathers to be present in their children's lives?
Right, okay. Is that a bad question? Did I miss something? I don't understand. No, it's a great question. So, my daughter, Zen, she's, first of all, my daughter's amazing, first of all. She sleeps through the night. Yeah. She doesn't cry. She's very responsive. She loves love. Like, she smiles when you're giving her love. Which is great because I'm very affectionate, so I'm like, okay, good, because you're gonna get a lot of this. I've always been a determined I've had a lot of motivation. I've always been very determined, very hungry, and I never knew that there could be more determination in me until she came out. Like, I was literally the first person to hold my daughter. And this rush that came through me, it was a lot of emotions. I cried, you know, she was in my arms. It was an amazing experience. And the promises that I have, you know, that I'm going to keep for her, and just the connection that I already have, never knowing I could love someone so much, you know, someone that's a part of me. It's been a surreal experience so far. As far as the absentee fathers, it's unfortunate that's a thing where there is a lot of that happening. I've had many friends, cousins, be in that situation. Fortunately, in my family, like, I come from, you know, just in my line, you know, from my father, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, my great-great-grandfather, we've been there, you know, that's because that's what you're supposed to do. You know, you got to be a responsible man, and you're supposed to provide for your children, and you are your child's first teacher along with the mother. And it is our duty to be there to provide support, to provide love, and teach them what we know. And then at the same time, I think in minority communities, it's really important for us to know, because this is, I've noticed the thing with the generation before us or older generation. Like, yes, I birthed, like I've helped in the creation of my daughter, but I don't own her. She has to be her own person. She's gonna grow into her own person.
Sure.
I can't force my beliefs on her. I could, you know, at the beginning, maybe I could only teach her what I know. And then when she goes off and she's learning her own things, and it's gonna be her decision in the world. You know, when she's out there, she's gonna meet a lot of people at school. I ain't raised those kids, you know, so they're being taught at home something else. They're from different backgrounds. And so she's gonna pick what's useful to her in her mind, or what she feels useful to her and what's not. And I can't punish her for having her own beliefs and being her own person, you know, because I do not own her. And I think that's something that a lot of people should hear and learn from, I feel, because I've seen it on both sides, you know, and seeing the parents where there's an open communication. I want her to feel very comfortable to come to me, to share whatever, whether she knows she did something wrong or right. And for me not to, even if it disappoints me, of course, I could express that. I'm human being. I could express that, but I'm not. There's nothing to lash out, feeling like, oh, like, you know, you're mine, and you're just what you're supposed to do. Don't wear this. Don't wear that. You know, all that stuff. Yeah, so much. I just as father, I'm just like, yeah, excited to talk about all that. Sorry. And then for the fathers, and I think the importance of having a father in the household is just. I did a study my first year in college, and just showing the studies of the households that did not have the biological father, and just the numbers that, I mean, the numbers of people in prison, teenage pregnancy, violence, just a lot of misguided individuals. Because there's only so much either which way, whether whether just the father's in life without the mother or just the mother, it's so much you can only do just as one parent, because we all know that it took two of you to make me. So I'm going to have questions about one side, you know, or, you know, I might inherit something that has nothing to do with you, and it's from another side, and I have no answers for that. I'm always hoping that there's just, like, you know, when we're seeing positive, you know, fathers out there, black fathers out there, you know, I'm hoping that rubs off on people before they have their children. They're like, oh man, like that's so, like, I hope to be that one day, hope to have that relationship with my child, because this is the biggest responsibility you can have in the world.
You know, I think it's always important when we bring up the absentee father question to acknowledge that 1 in 3 black men are gonna end up in prison at some point in their life,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So some of the absenteeism is by structural design, right? Of how they police our streets and police our communities. So I do wanna acknowledge that some fathers are absent because they're in prison. Right. But secondly, I think it's important to say that just because a father doesn't live in the house doesn't mean that the father's absentee.
Right.
Now, my father was absentee, but there are fathers who don't live in the household with their kid because they just can't get along with the mom, right? I mean, some relationships just don't work,
right?
And, you know, the people who try to stick it out for the kids, that ends up falling apart later on, right? Doing more damage to the kids. Because there's also this phenomenon of fathers who are present, but you can't feel their presence, right? So being in the house is not, being in the house, there's definitely value to it, but I also always want to, because the numbers are always, the way they tell our numbers is, right, black men aren't taking care of their kids, and they base that on us not being in the home.
Right.
Which is not true, because I know a lot of fathers who live across town, they send money, they go pick up kids, they do Chuck E. Cheese runs, right? That's present. They show up to games, ballet.
Yeah.
And so we got nuance that conversation. We got nuance how they tell us what those numbers look like.
Yeah, yeah. I think to piggyback off that real quick is that, I didn't literally mean the house, I just mean presence.
Yeah.
But also because, so on paper, My parents are still married on paper, okay? But the marriage isn't quite the best. I'm always open and honest when I'm having these conversations. Sleep in different rooms, don't communicate. And it's been like that for years. Even to the point when I was younger, honestly, I would hustle my parents so much I asked both of them for money for the same thing, because they didn't talk. I knew what I was doing. I was like, oh, mom, it's $75 for this field trip. Can I get, ask your dad? I did. He said no. And she's like, okay. Hey, your dad, $75 for the same thing. So, and then me and my siblings were exposed to things we should have never been exposed to. When you're talking about abuse verbally, physically, you know, mentally, you know, as at a young age. So just because, you know, both are, that doesn't mean, you know, me and the mother, my child, were never romantically involved, but we're being responsible in knowing that Zen is a priority that's coming out of the situation. And we're a good team for her, and she's never going to be exposed to the toxic stuff that I was exposed to as a child. And she's going to have a healthy, nothing but love upbringing, because there's nothing but love there. And I understand, like, now, part of my family, and I welcome that, you know what I mean? And it's not, I'm always positive. I wouldn't down talk her in front, especially in front of Zen, you know what I mean? But there's no even reason for us to even have those type of negative conversations. We're just not there. So, you know, to clarify that.
And just so you all know, Sharonis is going to be around after service for a little while to take pictures and to answer more questions. We're gonna take one more just in, to respect everyone's time. We'll take you right here.
Thank you. Wow. I just had a question. I just want you to speak on passion and purpose. I know that you have you had a long time basketball career, and I wanted to know if you can speak on transitioning into acting and how that felt as it relates to passion and purpose.
Right. Thank you. I love talking about this particular one. So I always knew I wanted to be in the film business since I was 5 years old. First time I saw Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, right? I saw Will Smith on there, and I was like, I don't understand what that necessarily is, but I know I want to be a part of that, right? But as I kept playing sports, kept getting taller, it was getting more serious, getting recruited, all that stuff, and I thought I was supposed to do that, right? Which I loved. But I knew this was my passion. And then, you know, I kind of shied away from it a little bit, thinking, I was like, man, you know, I'm too tall. They're gonna think I'm an athlete and everything like that, getting nervous about it. And I never gave myself permission. You know, we talked about I wasn't enough. I didn't feel like I was enough for that. Even if I knew I had a talent to do that, I was feeling like I was gonna be judged too much because of what I am. You know, being a brother who hoops, that's all I felt I was gonna be seen as. And a lot of times they definitely don't take athletes serious when they transition to that. And I mean, there's a lot of athletes who have kind of tried, but they don't really put the work in, so they're not the best actors. But I just remember my senior year of high school, I took a theater class for elective, and her name was Miss Mastroianni, and she was the first person, because I worked hard in that class, because I was like, I really love this stuff. And she was the first person to be like, you know, I know you're gonna be an athlete, and you know, you're getting a scholarship, and you're gonna go to school for, you know, that. But you know, later on or whenever you want to, I feel like if you wanted to act, you could actually do something in this. And I remember just being like, whoa, somebody besides myself saying I could do this? I was like, wow. And so the main thing was basically like saying is when I finally gave myself permission and I made that decision, was like, you know what? I'm gonna do that. It was so freeing because my mentality just shifted and my energy and my focus, everything shifted. And that doesn't just go into this, it goes into everything, right? And, you know, one of my favorite, you know, sayings is that you are what you attach to I am, right? Which is so strong to me because that, and starting going into these, at the beginning of my career, going to these audition rooms, still having that lingering thought like, man, they're gonna think I'm too tall for this. I'm too mixed for this. They don't understand my look or this, whatever. I'm too young for this, too, whatever. Like, once I was giving myself permission, I had the belief, and it was just like Muhammad Ali said, you know, it's a series of affirmations that turn into a deep conviction after a while. And like, just giving myself these, and actually believing in what I'm saying, not just saying them to be like, oh, you are this, and in the back of my mind, not believing. No, actually believing it. I started going off there, and I'm just giving them this energy that I am what you, you know, I'm supposed to be in this, or I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. I am an actor, I am a writer, whatever, all that stuff. And so that journey, and especially that transition from being a basketball player to, I use that as an advantage. I was like, you know, I'm a basketball player, I'm about to do all these basketball commercials, collect these checks, and get to know people and let the, and build some, like, you know, some rapport on set, so then I could finally get an agent. They could start sending me out on auditions, and then I could start booking a role, and then get blessed enough to be on something like Insecure, where it has nothing to do with no street role, no athlete. I'm not a rapper on there. It's just me being a man that's living his life in a career, and I can be normalized and just be a tall brother living in the world. Because let me tell you something. Not everybody over 6'5 making the NBA, right, Jay? We both out here getting it, right? So, it's like, right? So, you know, we don't just die off. You know what I'm saying? I had a 6'7 doctor. I've had a 6'10 substitute teacher before. I've had all types of tall people in my life. And so, it's okay to see us on there. You know what I mean? But I had to believe it first. And then let somebody else believe that in me, and now people are just seeing me, and it's just what it is. They just see me as, you know, on there as somebody else. So, yeah.
Hi, everyone. Won't you help me give God thanks and the gift of Jackson and Pastor Billy Pesco? Come on, let's celebrate that one more time. I'll be thankful for being here and still. Listen, we're getting ready to dismiss, but as we hold doors, we always want to close this service in prayer. As always, whenever we end a Kaya service, we want to be mindful of the fact that somebody might be here who wants to connect with the work of the Alpha Tree Baptist Church. You've seen God moving in this space in new and creative ways. This does not happen in every church. And we thank God for how God speaks to us through multiple avenues in this space. So if you want to join Alpha Street, or if you want to initiate a relationship with Jesus Christ, our deacons will be here on your right, my left, by this door on this side, if you want to become a part of the work that God is doing in this place. And then lastly, don't forget to pick up your gala, your tickets for the 10th anniversary Kaya event on January 26th. It's going to be amazing. You don't want to miss those before they sell out. So, an orderly line for pictures. If you want to come part of Alpha Street, this door over here on your right. And then don't forget to get your gala tickets online, alphatreat.org. As we look to God to close, let's join hands for a word of prayer. Let's touch and agree all over the sanctuary as we look to God. God, our Creator, thank you for reminding us tonight that you formed us in the midst of darkness. And that through every situation and season of our lives, you continue to shape and mold us and make us better. So God, I'm yet believing that as we leave from this place, but never from your presence, God, you're going to continue to mold us into all that you are calling us to become. God, we thank you that we are simply clay in the potter's hands. And God, we walk into tomorrow with great expectation for what you're about to do. So God, right now, I press into my neighbor's hands a new opportunity. I squeeze into my sister's hands some new joy. I press into my brother's hands a chance to love again. God, I'm yet believing that you're going to do something in the life of my neighbor that's going to go exceedingly abundantly and above all they could ask or think. So God, I bless you for that. Not only that, God, I press a good night of sleep into my neighbor's hands. God, I'm believing that no stress, no confusion, no worry, no anxiety, no fear is going to interrupt their sleep tonight. But God, I'm believing that you're going to do something to restore them so that they may walk into tomorrow ready to conquer all that stands in their way. God, we love you, God. We simply ask for your protection and your grace and your mercy to cover us as we leave from this place. And we look forward to meeting you back here soon. And we can simply say thank you for the work you're doing in our life. In Jesus' name we do pray. Amen. Go in the grace of God, and may the grace of God go with you.